From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a father made a comment about his 6-year-old daughter, Maria, who was learning to play an instrument. They would attend lessons with Lauren Haley, a professional violinist and a graduate, by the way, of the Eastman School of Music. And Maria's dad was frustrated that things weren't clicking right away. He would tell Lauren, "I know she's smart. I know Maria could be talented. The problem is that she's lazy," end quote. Well, Lauren Haley wasn't really buying it. She's the founder of Lauren Haley Studios, which enrolls young musicians studying violin and viola, and she knows that instruments take time, but concluding that kids are just lazy is not only counterproductive, it's almost always not true. So Lauren wrote a book called Kids Aren't Lazy, Developing Motivation and Talent Through Music. She lives in Houston, but she's back in Rochester as a guest at the University of Rochester for an event today. And we asked Lauren to join us to discuss how kids overcome significant obstacles. That's a big part of, say, learning to play violin. It's also part of life in general. And Lauren will deliver a public talk about her book and her work today. That's all coming up tonight if you want to attend, 6 p.m. at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. They would love to see you there. It's open to the public. But first, she's our guest here on Connections. Welcome back to Rochester. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. I'm excited to be here.
And also with us is Herb Smith, who's a trumpeter with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. Welcome back.
Thank you, man. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Dr. Kathleen Baines is here. Dr. Baines is a child psychiatrist and director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me here.
Do you play an instrument?
I do. I played the piano, flute, and piccolo growing up, but more importantly, I'm the parent of 2 young kids who are learning the piano as well.
Oh, how old?
They're 8 and 10, just
about. Oh, see, this is perfect, because this is one, the thing that I thought coming into sort of reading this book and thinking about what we're going to discuss today. Number one, selfishly, since I have a nearly 8-year-old who is doing his best with violin, I feel like a lot of adults in our sphere have stories where we go, boy, I wish I hadn't quit piano lessons.
Oh,
I
man.
I wish I would have stayed with it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But definitely. Apparently you didn't quit.
Well, some would say that that is not a top priority in my world right now.
Okay. But you can sit down and pound some stuff out, right?
Okay.
I think that's what some adults want, even if they're not doing it professionally like Lauren. And I do think that we can relate to this idea that, well, why did I quit? Why did my parents let me quit? Why didn't they make me go? I mean, that's how often do you hear that now in your world?
Oh, all the time. In fact, I have several families in my studio where the parents and their children study music together because the parents have rediscovered how fun it is to share music as a family many years after they quit their instrument in high school.
And so you wrote the book, Kids Aren't Lazy, Developing Motivation and Talent Through Music. And the book is out now. Again, a public talk tonight at 6 p.m. But primarily, what are you hoping people take away from the book and the conversation today?
You know, my favorite thing about studying music is it's a vessel for developing what psychologists call soft skills. And these skills can truly help us in other areas of our life. And so I'm talking about persistence and appreciation for the trial and error process, understanding the value of creativity and understanding that, you know, creativity comes in so many forms. It's not just, you know, classical violin. It's visual arts. It's dance. It's jazz. All of these areas of study can help us develop these soft skills. And we can take that with us even into our academics and family lives.
And that's one of the themes of the book as well, which we will get to coming up. When were you at Eastman? Well, you don't have to give me the actual dates, but because that's actually sort of an unfair question. Let me just reroute the question. Did you enjoy your time at Eastman?
Absolutely. I graduated here in 2013.
Okay. And what was home for you growing up?
Oh, we lived all over the place. And what was so exciting about that was that every time my family moved, I had the opportunity to work with a new teacher on violin. And it gave me a perspective on teaching and how there are so many different ways to work with young musicians. And so I really hope my students benefit from that.
Why did you stick with violin?
Oh, I fell in love with violin, hopelessly in love with violin.
So it was easy for you.
Yeah.
You wanted to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what it was is when I was 5, my mother took me to a high school performance of Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf. I looked up on the stage, saw the violinists, begged for a violin. My parents gave me a cello in the beginning. They didn't want to listen to a violinist practice. They'd heard it could be squeaky. I begged for a violin. And eventually I won. I got my violin.
And when you ended up in Rochester, I mean, what was it that brought you and attracted you to come to the Eastman School to begin with?
You know, I, as much as I knew I loved violin, I also really loved other subjects, including writing. And the University of Rochester, being so close to Eastman and so involved with Eastman, gave me the opportunity to make no compromises musically, yet still pursue academics.
So here you are, teaching, and you've got parents like the one that I mentioned at the outset. And when you hear parents say, God, if kids just weren't lazy, they could say, what do you say to parents when you hear that?
Well, of course, it's so relatable. And I also know that it's easy to look over at a recital at another family's child and say, wow, that kid is so motivated, so talented. Why aren't we? And so I like parents to remember that we can reframe our definition of motivation and talent. Motivation is, it's this little kick that you get after accomplishing something that, you know, spurs you on to accomplish new things. Talent is really the sum of skills you've already learned that make it easier to acquire new skills. So, musically speaking, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star is the most difficult song in the world. Because kids haven't yet built a repertoire of skills for learning notes. By the time your child is on the Tchaikovsky Concerto, well, things aren't so bad. You've got a lot of skills for conquering these notes. When we reframe motivation and talent in this way, these skills can be developed in absolutely everyone.
Do you have, and I'll ask all three of our musicians on the panel, do you have moments in your own childhood where you can remember the first time someone clapped for you, or even if it was like a little home gathering and you played Twinkle Twinkle or something?
Absolutely. When I was young, my grandmother, she would just sit on the couch and ask me to play her favorite song. Well, a few years ago, I realized in hindsight, she had a suspicious number of favorite songs. And that was just her way of sparking some joy in me to make me want to play and understand that sharing music mm-hmm. can be really a wonderful gift.
That's cool. Herb, we've talked about your story in the past on this program.
But yes.
What stands out for why you were someone who became a professional musician? What worked for you?
That's, wow, just when you were asking her that question, I was just kind of like trying to think about it. I know for me, it was just a total love of music. Like,
even early on, though?
I saw the trumpet, didn't know what it sounded like, heard it, and was in love. And it's the same till today. Like, I just loved it, you know, and I never got tired of it, you know, like tears, I'm crying, I'm upset, I'm playing my trumpet, just that's just what it was. And just from day one, that's what it was. But I was thinking about the time that I heard applause mm-hmm. that kind of remind, and I think what it was I was in fifth grade with my band director, Mr. Dooley. And we did an arrangement of Kenny Rogers' Still. Remember that song, Still? It's an old, you don't even know that song.
I know Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
I'm trying to
Kenny
think of
Rogers.
Still. So Megan Mack will know. She knows all that.
Think of a fifth grade band doing an arrangement of Kenny Rogers' songs.
Sing it for me, Herb.
Oh, God, I don't remember the song. I'm not going to do that. But I had a trumpet solo in that thing. And I played that, stood up and played the solo. And people clapped and... That was like the first kind of taste of, wow, you know, 10-year-old kid playing the trumpet. Yeah, this might be a good thing.
You get a little kick from that applause?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, that's kind of how Lauren's defining motivation. That's kind of a non-drug drug that you get. You go, I want more of that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Hmm.
Now, Dr. Baines, do you have a moment in your kind of past where you think, that was awesome, I wanted to keep playing because of this?
Well, as I was listening to that, I was thinking about the idea of applause as related but a little bit different to the idea of looking to someone that you love for the twinkle in their eye, mm-hmm. right?
Uh-huh. Sure.
And that seems to be you know, the thing that motivates the individual, right?
Yeah.
But something about that applause, seeking that out, that's already after the love for the music or the craft has deepened.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so that's where the relationship that starts off as looking to a parent or a loved one for that twinkle in the eye transitions to instead almost a relationship with the instrument itself,
yeah.
It sounded like.
Yeah.
But I've got two people here.
Mm-hmm.
Herb saw the trumpet trombone.
Trumpet.
And he loved it.
Loved it.
Yeah. I mean, here's someone who wanted a violin no matter how squeaky. Loved it. That doesn't happen for all kids.
It doesn't.
And parents are in that sort of conundrum where they go, well, I want them to keep doing it. They should keep doing it. They have to keep. I'm going to make them keep doing it. I don't care what it takes. They're going to keep doing it.
Right.
How do you negotiate this? What's a good way of approaching this?
So it's essentially, what's the way that we negotiate teaching anything to a child, right, that doesn't automatically align with their sort of preferred activities? Mm-hmm. And we could probably argue that most of life involves some of those kind of activities,
of
right?
Preferred activities.
Non-preferred
right.
activities, right? So how do we do that, right? And part of that is I think exactly what Lauren had mentioned in her book, which is being present with them and validating all of that hard work and effort and seeing what it means and really validating also those sort of soft skills, those column two skills that people learn when they're doing things that otherwise, you know, are not as enjoyable at first.
This is so true. And, you know, I talk about this in the book because as much as I talk about how much I love the violin, and I do, I know there were absolutely moments in my studies at Eastman and before Eastman where I honestly thought I'd had enough of this. Like, could I pick something, you know, could I have picked a harder subject? The violin's pretty difficult. And so I tell my students that no matter what we do, sometimes work is really fun, it's really exciting, and sometimes work is work. And this is true no matter what we study. So instead of looking to our chosen subject or career path to always provide enjoyment, I think it's important to acknowledge, okay, hey, today, this particular Tuesday, you know, this task that I have to do on the instrument is work. And I'm okay with that because I know that there's going to be another day where I am head over heels in love with it.
I mean, violin is quite an exam.
Yeah.
I mean, people who quit it go to quantum physics for something easier.
It's true.
But Herb, for you, how do you view the idea of quote unquote making kids do it, or how you get kids to kind of buy in?
That's a balance for me. That's a real balance, you know, because some kids shouldn't play an instrument. I feel like for just, you know, some kids perhaps.
This is controversial,
not,
Herb.
Yeah, I know. For some kids, that's just not their path.
Okay.
You know, that's not their path. And it's sometimes tough to discern, you know, what's their path, what's not their path, when to allow them to move on or when to hold them in. You know, I think it's a real discernment on that as far as, and like my mom always said to me, and she always brags, I never had to tell him to practice. Just never did. He would go in there and just practice on his own. I know if my mom would hear me do that voice, she'd get mad at me, but but she didn't. You know, it was just kind of a thing for me, you know, and so I have a daughter, you know, and she started off on violin, and I had her go to lessons and stuff, and you know, looking at your book, a lot of the things that you were talking about in the book, as a teacher, you know, I was doing some of those things with her, just allowing her and not like, you know, get in there, you know, practice, but I did allow her to end up quitting the violin, because I was just seeing a pattern that it wasn't necessarily her path. And then she actually let go of violin. Mm-hmm. Now she's singing, and that is her path, mm-hmm. you know? So it's tough with that, you know? And mm-hmm. I know that part of your book is the relationship between the parent and the student. And so you can really, you know, discern where the student is.
And if I could just jump in and say, and by the way, I'll take a phone call in just a second. Miriam and Geneseo wants to share some regrets about having quit an instrument. But before we even get there, I think what you're describing is sort of some of the extremes here, which is, you know, for you, not having to be told to practice. You're
right.
Going to practice as a kid. I'm in there. I'm doing it. Nobody has to tell me.
Right.
On the other end, you know, in your own definition, Herb, the idea that not all kids need to play an instrument or might not be a fit for all kids.
Right.
In the middle is this idea of how many of us are in the middle that with the right sort of pushing and approach,
right,
and sort of work to create love for something, we can get a lot out of it without sort of being dragged for years.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not the easy thing to figure out. I mean, right. When you figure out, this is the moment where I'm going to let my daughter say, you're going to let it go.
Right.
That's not
right.
an easy moment.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, especially being a musician, you know, I was like, you know, don't you want to do this? You know, come on. You know.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about one of, I thought, the most important parts of the book is on overcoming obstacles and the idea of the value of obstacles.
Yeah.
I don't hear Herb saying obstacles are bad, no kid should have them, give up early. Mm-hmm. It's no. a discernment process,
yes, it
right?
is.
Right.
It's
and
a
it's
discernment.
Not easy yeah. to do that.
It's not.
Right.
So before we add to that, Miriam and Geneseo has the story of wishing there wasn't a given up. Go ahead, Miriam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I think probably if I hadn't jumped the gun and called, I would have just heard my answer if I'd waited. But this is actually my husband's story. He's very musical. I mean, very few people I've met who appreciate it the same way he does. Loves it, loves it, loves it. But he took piano, and he was a very squirrely, physical, body kinetic kid and didn't have the patience and just really wouldn't do the work and wouldn't keep up with it. So finally they just, you know, they let him stop. He feels like they missed the beat on him, that they dropped the ball. He is still sort of like, I wouldn't say bitter, but he's very disappointed. He feels like they should have known, they should have kept me going. It's like, but every time you talk to me about it, you say there was no way you were going to put in the time. You wanted to play baseball. You didn't want to do it. So how, you know, that he really feels the lack of that. He feels like he missed something by not having been, I don't know if you could say forced, mm-hmm. but I mean, you can't place your hand on another kid's hand and force them to practice, put their hands on the keys. So what would have been the answer with somebody like him? Listening to you a little bit more after I got in the queue for you to take the call, maybe it was the wrong instrument, maybe something like drums where he could have beat the holy heck out of something and then have a more physical instrument, you know, or you know, I don't know, drumline, something where he could have moved at the same time. I don't know. But it's just sad because he sort of, blame's a strong word, but I'll just use it anyway. He blames the adults in his life for not having picked up that was a language he spoke and that he could have, if they found the key, they could have unlocked that in him. I'll take my answer off the air, but thanks for listening to me. Thank
yeah,
you.
Miriam, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Lauren.
I love this question. I like families who are studying music and maybe struggling to remember two things. So the first thing is that, you know, like we said earlier, music is a vessel for learning soft skills. And especially when I start teaching a new student, if they're 3, if they're 4, if they're 5, so often we have to learn for the first time, how do we work one-on-one with an adult? How do we work at home to create a practice routine? Really, the focus is on those skills supporting the development of musicality, as opposed to just like, hey guys, it's really important that you learn Ode to Joy. The second thing I like families to remember when they're studying music is that you're working together on a subject that can open doors down the road. So even if a child, you know, right now, you know, they're 15 years old, they're exhausted, they're busy, they put violin on the back burner, you've already opened the door for them later on in their life to appreciate music, to enjoy it, to work on it with their own families someday. And so it's not all or nothing. Mm-hmm. Music lessons are about so much more than any individual piece you could ever play.
I would also say, yeah, it's never too late.
Ooh, yeah.
Lauren's book says when you turn 40, you cannot learn piano anymore.
That's
not true.
I just
turned 40 and I'm looking for an excuse because
wow,
I want to learn
that
piano.
Was great. Like
going,
my eyes went big. I said, whoa.
Lauren's
I
going, you read
that.
The wrong book. That
I
is not actually
that.
In her book.
I am going to get in so much trouble with my adult
but honestly,
students.
It's never
it's
too
harder,
late.
It's harder though, isn't it?
It's harder, yeah. But however, like there are groups out there, like for people that are beginning an instrument later in life, like the Horizons, New Horizons, there's mm-hmm. different, and these groups are great. Like they get the same feeling and love of music and play at a high level. And, you know, for me, I play in in professional orchestras. I play in the Rochester Phil. When I go and work with some of these students, the love that they have for the music sometimes is deeper than the love of, you know, a classically trained professional musician who's just doing it every day. Like, love is love, you know, and it doesn't matter if you're at a super high level or if you're at a super low level. And I think people, you know, he's feeling upset about that, but I'm like, dude, man, like, pick up an instrument and go and learn and then join these bands with other people that are in the same boat as you. And then you can enjoy that music. It's never too late.
So that's for Miriam's husband. That's really for me, too, if I want to learn piano.
Oh, yeah.
Never too late.
Go for
right
it.
Down the street, you can take some lessons.
And it's so true, by the way, about
I got
New
a piano.
New Horizons.
I'll sell you for $25.
It's so true about New Horizons, the great work they do.
Yes,
we've covered
yes.
that, and it's really great. But Dr. Baines, kind of take me through your thoughts as you hear Miriam say he actually kind of blames the adults in his life, like he has resentment still.
So I was hearing a couple of things from that. The first one was that it is true we learn as much from our losses as we do from our gains, right?
Yes.
And that those things, those experiences that we have that we regret, sometimes become the formative substrate for what we choose to do later in life that is healthy or, you know, promotional. So that's one thing. I also think that there's a narrative in her family, the way that she described it, that has the potential for future generations, right? I imagine that her husband would share that loss with, say, younger family members, right, in a way that was inspiring and really paid attention to Lauren's book and the lessons to sort of shape the way a future generation would learn music. So I think that's one of the promising things about reflecting on those kind of experiences in your life.
So not too late. And by the way, got a comment from David, who says, David says, I say you should come to the Recorder Society and learn to play recorder. That's what I have done with a similar background.
Right.
Having a great experience. So,
right.
So there's outlets.
Mm-hmm.
There's places to go.
There are.
And so, Miriam, good luck. That's just so interesting to kind of feel that almost visceral still resentment. Because
yeah.
I've been there. So let's talk about obstacles, because the book hits that. And I want to read a little bit. Before I grab this section, I want to read. You open your book mentioning the obstacles that some of the biggest names, I mean, I think Dvorak and Beethoven, among others you're referencing, pretty big obstacles before they became the names that we know.
Yeah, Dvorak's father wanted him to become a butcher, and lucky for us, Dvorak became a composer.
I don't know, he could have been the best butcher.
That's true.
And there's nothing wrong with butchery. There ain't nothing wrong with butchery. Beethoven, you said, had, if I remember, an alcoholic father who...
Mm-hmm. He would wake him up in the middle of the night and demand that he practiced. And so it's funny.
Which seems like a way to drive someone away from it.
Right. Yeah. Because it's funny because so often, you know, it's easy to look at children and say like, oh gosh, you know, why isn't my child like Beethoven or Mozart? And then we think, you know what? Actually, there was some really unhealthy behavior there. We're in a much better place to have a very healthy relationship with each other and with music. And, you know, we can develop some great skill together.
So let me read a couple paragraphs from your section on obstacles. And, you know, I think we have sort of varying perspectives on obstacles, knowing that nobody here is saying, let them quit if they don't want to do it just for no reason, but assess the right thing to do. But this is what Lauren says about what can happen if you kind of allow that to overcome you. They're concerned about how hard something is. You write, quote, pulling the plug on musical study in the face of difficulty is like selling stock at an all-time low. When you do so, you lock in the losses. If you let your child quit their studies when the musical path feels rocky, they lose their musical potential. Further, quitting risks validating a young musician's perception that they should be talented at any pursuit before it's then worth the effort. Instead, the best time to invest in your child's musical ability is when they require that extra support. By providing additional emotional and strategic musical support at these times, you invest effectively in your child's ability to grow, and you contribute positively to their future success. The key is to remember that every musician, without exception, has faced challenges. Except for Herb. Recognize the obstacles in your child's path for what they truly are, growth opportunities in disguise. So that speaks for itself. You want to add a little bit to the importance you see of how we evaluate obstacles?
Yeah. So what I do with my own studio families is we talk about the difference between growth obstacles. And so those are like, you know, difficult assignments given purposefully by teachers that help you grow and develop, and hindrance obstacles. And hindrance obstacles are like the logistics obstacles. These are things that, you know, through no fault of this child's own, he's missing every other orchestra rehearsal because it conflicts with soccer, you know. Hindrance obstacles are best resolved by the adults in a child's life. This is where educators, administrators, and parents come in. So, for example, a few years ago, I accepted a student into my studio, and the first day of our first lesson, her father called me to say that my student had left her violin at home or at the school because she had this huge case. And so she was not in the habit of bringing it home every day. Well, you know, when she came to class finally and I saw what she was trying to carry back and forth to school every day, I thought, you know, goodness, I would leave that at school and at home and all sorts of places too. You know, it's 97 degrees outside in Houston. and so the first thing we did was say, okay, this is unnecessarily getting in our way. It's the wrong size. And we just exchanged at the shop for a lighter case. Now she could take her instrument with. We had gotten rid of that excuse. And, you know, it just made it that much easier to focus on what mattered.
Hmm. And now, as I think of your success in your career, for example, Herb, I want to ask you a question, like, no cheekiness here.
Okay.
Do you recall moments where you felt like, this is not going to happen with this. I'm not going to get this. Or do you recall moments where you go, I got it. Like, you felt like you'd scaled a mountain.
I mean, there were always challenges, you know, in playing the instrument and, you know, injuries and stuff mm-hmm. where you think things are going to end. But there was always, for me, this, like, it's about trumpet. You know, I was just going to figure it out. I was going to work it through. You know, I've never had any feelings of, I'm done. You know, and I've always said, when I feel like I'm done, I'm just going to quit. But at this point, I feel like I'm going to be that guy that played a gig on Thursday and died on Friday. Like, that's pretty much what it's going to be. Just music all the way, you know. But at the same time, with some of my students, you know, there have been a lot of challenges. Like for brass, you know, you talk about some of those challenges are braces.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so braces, when you're playing an instrument, a trumpet, it can really just, like, if you're at a high level, then you get braces and it takes you down low. There's a lot of depression. There's a lot of anxiety about that because you used to be here. Now you're here, you know. And so, like, that's a lot of times when there has to be some lifting, some supporting to be like, it's, you know, you're going to be I'm not going to let you quit now. Because this is just, we have an obstacle here. When this obstacle is over, then let's work through this. You know, and it's sometimes that obstacle is removed and they take off, and sometimes not. You know, it's just that discerning, you know, where does that come? But yeah, seriously, I deal with, you know, obstacles. But for me, I don't know, I'm just weird, I guess.
I think that's such a great point, because we want to remember that in any orchestra or class of young musicians, these hindrance obstacles don't hit all of our students evenly. Mm-hmm, maybe right. Our growth mm-hmm. obstacles, you know, as teachers, we have control over the growth obstacles and we can assign those appropriately. But hindrance obstacles are complicated because you have students competing for, say, the same grade, the same chair.
Right.
And they have a completely different set of struggles to earn it.
After our early break of the hour, we're going to talk to Dr. Baines about how she views not only this section of the book, but how it pertains so far beyond music. Because for parents, especially now, raising kids, there's all these distractions, there's all these things. And in some sense, there's a million things a kid could be doing at any time during the day. And if you're the kind of parent who's wondering, why can't they just focus and finish a task or gain skills, etc.? What's the right way to deal with getting them over the hump of certain things? What do we do? How do we deal with discouragement? It's not just music. That's the sort of the universality of this theme, and we're going to hit that with Dr. Baines on the other side. We're talking about the book Kids Aren't Lazy, Developing Motivation and Talent Through Music, The author, Lauren Haley, is a graduate of the Eastman School of Music, and she is back in Rochester today. She's given a free public presentation, and they would love to see you tonight at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. That's at 6 p.m., 6 to 7:30, free and open to the public, and parking available in the library lot right there. So Lauren Haley will be there for that. Herb Smith is with us in studio, a trumpeter with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. And Dr. Baines is a child psychiatrist and director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, we talk about a rising tide of anti-Semitism, how to recognize it, and what to do about it. And then we'll also discuss where the primary process goes for Democrats after New Hampshire. President Trump says he is confident no matter who the opponent is. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says his moment is now. We'll discuss it on Connections. This is Connections, and Dr. Baines, we're going to hit that question on obstacles in children. And it relates to music, but it relates to life in so many ways. But let's tackle it from the perspective of music, and then we'll sort of broaden it out here. You've got a kid who's, well, your kids are 10 and 8. Mine's almost 8.
Almost.
And he likes violin. But there's nights where he doesn't really want to practice it, doesn't want to do it. I'd be surprised at this point if he wanted to quit, but I'd be disappointed too. And I don't know what I would say in that moment. I don't know, you know, I would probably wrestle with the idea of, well, hell no, you're not quitting.
Right.
But then I think the best kind of motivation, the best kind of scenario is where he wants to do, maybe not what Herb did, which is practice all the time on his own without being told, but a different sort of thing where it doesn't always feel like a chore.
Right.
How do we do this?
So Herb's a unicorn. Right? We should just, from here on.
Yeah.
But that section really got me fired up because I was thinking about the way that we're talking about obstacles and the development of self-esteem. And as a psychiatrist, what gets me fired up is when we ask people to work towards developing their sense of self or working towards self-esteem while setting themselves up to fail, right? Because there are so many hindrance obstacles, the kind of obstacles that are incidental to the task at hand and that usually require an adult or an external person to get out of the way in order to make success. Real self-esteem happens when there are growth-promoting obstacles, a small task that's a step beyond what you can currently do that builds self-esteem and confidence in your capacity to master new challenges in life. And so the key in all of those self-esteem building activities is to make sure that the next step isn't too large or too impossible and that you have the right supportive, nurturing environment around you as you tackle that task to build up a positive sense of efficacy. And so that's where the music piece is so powerful for me because, you know, you hear what you do, you see this positive reinforcement for the work and the effort you put in. And the job of all of the adults around us, around children who are learning music, is to pay attention to how can I get rid of the hindrance obstacles, the ones that are inconvenient, like a too large violin case, you know, or a travel schedule that's obnoxious, and make it so that kids can find that internal substrate for learning music, developing confidence in their sense of self.
Don't sit there and watch SportsCenter in the same room when they're trying to practice violin.
That'd do it. That'd be one strategy. But, you know, it takes a lot of effort sometimes to come up with those strategies that, you know, are surprising.
But if we're clearing the deck of hindrance obstacles, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if a child says to you, that's it, I'm done with this. And you know in your heart that you don't think that's the right thing for them to do, you know, can you generalize about this, Dr. Baines, and say, put a line in the sand and say, not yet, no?
So whenever we're working with kids, right, our goal is that kids learn about themselves, right? And so if a kid says no, we want to listen to it, but we also want to make sure that the kid is saying no because it's right for them, it's coming from a place of strength. You know, I think especially in this society, right, we respect an individual's right to say no, you know, and that's an important skill set. But we want it to come from a place of strength, right, that's thoughtful and, you know, probably not at the place when they're trying to, you know, sell low their stock, right?
So there are times where it's okay to say, okay, you've given this a shot, you don't want to do it, you hate it, because kids will say, I hate this. Hopefully they don't, but kids may hate sports. They may hate music. They may hate learning a foreign language, and they may tell you, I don't want this. I hate it. I guess you have to discern.
you have to discern if that's fear and anxiety driving that choice, or self-knowledge and new directions and new opportunities that are driving that change and that transition.
Also, like, if I could chime
Please.
In, like, one of the things that I really like about the book is how it really puts parents on notice that their behavior has to model what they want the kid to do. And I think one of the parts in the book is really making parents aware of how their speech is actually negating what they want to happen. So you're talking about these obstacles. Some of the obstacles are the way that the parents talk to the kids. Like, you know, like one of the things you were talking about is like they hear the kid practicing in the next room and they're yelling, that was a messed up, you know, fix that, you know, or whatever. That's not going to foster that love, which then down the road it is, I hate this instrument. So like if the parent is aware of his actions and modeling the type of behavior, like where the person messes up. Well, everybody messes up.
Absolutely.
You know, and when you mess up at work, you want a second chance. So now that you want to give your daughter or son that same type of thing.
Herb, to riff on that too, if you don't mind. You know, how do kids learn what to pay attention to in life? From the earliest of infancy, kids look to their parents to reference what they should pay attention to. And so when parents pay attention to the mistakes and the errors in judgment, that's what the kid starts to pay attention to.
Right.
When parents pay attention to the opportunities to change what they're doing to promote growth, that's what kids learn to pay attention to. It's called social referencing, and I think it's as applicable to music as it is to every other aspect of life.
My father used to say, kids, the things that kids learn, it's more caught than taught.
That's a great line.
That's awesome. That's really good.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I think that's so true because so often I'll have a family, you know, come to my studio and the parents are very enthusiastic. They're excited to be, you know, accepted into the studio. But then they'll sit down, you know, when they hear that I require them to sit and listen, they'll sit down on the couch, they'll put their headphones on and they'll start working on their laptops. And they really won't say anything in the beginning aside from if there's a wrong note, they'll kind of like gasp or go, hey, what was that? Fix it. And sometimes I think, you know, okay, they're doing that to show me that like they're strict too. But the message that they're actually giving their child is, hey, this trial and error process is unacceptable. It should never have been a squeak there. You should have fixed that before. And that's not what I want students to take away. What I want parents to help students understand is that if you want to be good at anything, you have to have a lot of enthusiasm for the trial and error process, especially in music, where, you know, we might have to work together to establish the violin bow hold 100 times at home before it sticks.
Oh, we did.
Oh, yeah. And we have to find a way to make that tolerable for our students who are, you know, children are used to getting things right the first time. You know, if we have to ask them to unload the dishwasher, you know, more than 5 times, that's like a big emergency. But with the bow hold, like I said, we're talking about something that we mention hundreds of times. And so it's crucial that parents reflect that enthusiasm for trial and error.
Can I read from your book on this?
Yeah.
On the subject of healthy criticism, on what is healthy and what works, because as I read this in the section, Harness Criticism to Build Self-Esteem, I'm really glad Dr. Baines is here because I want to also know if we can generalize about knowing that people are different, people respond to different criticism differently. People have different needs either for sort of reinforcement, building up, but can we generalize? So let me read from Lauren's book on the subject of criticism. Quote, the goal for criticism is simple. Teach students of any subject to keep their pencils moving, practice honest reflection, generate solutions, and strive for higher standards. To put this mathematically, improvement is the constant in your child's practicing equation each day. The variable is whether as whatever current challenge they face. Appropriate criticism empowers young musicians. Inappropriate criticism empowers doubt. Positive criticism builds new structures onto existing efforts. Destructive criticism tears down what has already been built. Where proper guidance builds skills, Ineffective criticism at best maintains the status quo, or worse, damages a child's belief in their own potential. While some level of conflict and frustration is inevitable over the years, as your child pursues an instrument, just ask any musician, parent, or teacher, successful practice with your child will hinge on your style of communication. So I want to ask if you think there's a general framework for what works, and I want to get everyone's take on this, because in my head, I'm hearing some parents who will probably say, well, I'm more strict or I'm more stern because that works. That's what keeps them on task. That's what sort of reminds, whereas some parents have a softer touch.
You know, my favorite way to teach is it's inspired by my own first teacher who never used the word no. And of course, I started studying with her when I was four. And four-year-olds, you have to tell four-year-olds no, surely. But her way of teaching was she would ask me questions about things I could improve. These are called guiding questions. And whenever I did something that was less than ideal, she'd give me something to do instead. And because she was so positive, that enabled me, even at a young age, to be really tolerant of the trial and error, do it 1,000 times process. If she had been, say, strict in a negative way instead of a positive way, I might not have put up with fixing my bow hold that 1,000 times. So my perspective is that if you communicate with students and with children in a positive way, you can actually get away with being more picky than you can if you are negative or harsh.
Okay. Herb, were there certain things that worked for you that didn't, that maybe you've navigated a relationship with your daughter in different ways and think, well, how come this worked for me and it didn't for her? How do you navigate that?
Well, like, so I teach a lot of students. Mm-hmm. So each student is different. You know, each student is different. And I know I'm thinking of, you know, and also, you know, I'm dealing with trumpet players. So, you know, trumpet players have a whole different thing than string players, maybe. I don't know. But I know just depending on the student, like some students, I just have to be, what are you doing? No, don't do that. And be a little bit more, and he hears that. He hears that. And then he goes and practices and comes back. And I'm like, yeah, man, that was great. You know, where other students, that's way too harsh for them. You know, So for other students, I'm just like, you know, oh, okay, well, why don't we try that again? You know, it's like depending on the student. Now you want to generalize about that, and I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, Lauren, about the positivity of it. It's just like when you start getting down to each student, it's that each kid is different.
Yeah.
You know, I'm more like, there's really no answer. It's more like the answer is specific for each student.
Yeah, I think that's so right. And I also think that when we work with students, we really want to be thinking, how do I want this young musician to sort of narrate their practice when they're older? Do I want them to be sweeping, you know, vague or negative? No, I want them to be picky, persistent, consistent. And often that means, especially for younger students, you know, being positive. Without that positivity, I found, you know, sometimes it's easy to lose the persistence too.
Okay. Right. Dr. Baines, can we make some general ideas about what is healthy criticism?
What I heard from both of them was the idea of being curious, right? That you want to encourage a child to be curious about what is going right or wrong and how to replicate that. And the way to do that is to have the parent or the teacher or whatever adult is supporting them in this endeavor to be curious about what works for them and how to know themselves better and then learn their craft better.
Can you identify in your own sort of practice moments where you think, generally speaking, that is too harsh? That kind of criticism is likely to backfire.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I know I've seen teachers where it's just like, okay, that's too much. Like, back off a little bit.
If you're throwing objects, that's probably, you've crossed a line.
Which has happened to me. A teacher has thrown stuff at me before.
Me too.
the other question too is, what's generating this feedback or this criticism or this assessment that you're sharing? Is it actually being generated by the kid, or is it being generated by the parent or the teacher from themselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had a line in the book, Lauren, about fear, right?
Yeah.
And when a parent is fearful about how their child is going to experience disappointment, that becomes an influencing fact for how then that child engages with the music. The more that the parent fears their child's experience of disappointment, the more it colors the whole experience.
I also want to ask you, as we think about our kids trying to learn and accomplish different things, whether it's music or anything, mm-hmm. if we have to assess our role and because I'm thinking about, let's say you've got a kid learning from Herb or Lauren. I mean, world class, trained, you know they're getting great musical education. You're trying to support that in some way. I think about when I was writing a book and feeling like this is never going to end, it's never going to happen, and then finally get into a rhythm. And so my father was my editor, and he was just the blunt hammer of truth. I mean, just vicious. I would send stuff to him, and he would just destroy it. And I knew that, like, and that was good for me, you know?
Right.
Then I remember having a conversation with a friend who was like, you know, this part didn't really work for me. And I actually kind of stopped, and I said, I just need you to lead with something positive. Like, I just come off, you know, Phil Dawson's blunt hammer of truth, which I needed. But I needed a little bit of a boost. And I actually said so, and I kind of felt weak in that moment. But I knew from my own psyche I needed that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if parents need to try to be careful to assess, what do you think your kid needs, and what's the appropriate way to handle that?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that we want to pay attention for is separating out the product of the effort and the effort, right? That what comes out of all of this work is not an expert violinist or an expert pianist, right?
Right.
But that's not the goal. The goal is to create a child who falls in love with their effort, who falls in love with finding their potential, who falls in love with the act of creating.
Right.
And I don't care what direction that goes in, frankly, but the idea is the effort, and then the creation is the most powerful part of all of it.
I love that. The fundamental, you know, motivation for a child to practice any subject, not just music, is the belief that something good will come from their work. So no matter how we work with them to help them improve, we want to make sure that they're very clear about the potential that they have. That, you know, I found that sometimes students don't share the belief in their own potential that to me as a teacher and to their parents seems so obvious. Young musicians are waiting for, you know, validation from the world that, yes, you've got something here, while secretly also waiting to be confirmed that, you know, no, that's right, you actually don't have talent. And I found that, you know, young musicians are pretty good at finding this this pushback from their friends and family. And so it's really important that we articulate, no, this is really good, actually. Yeah. This is how good things start, note by note. We're on the right path together. Your work is going somewhere.
You want to add to that, Herb?
No, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, that's important. I mean, and I'm just saying, like, different, that looks differently. Like, that sentiment can look differently for different students,
mm-hmm.
you know, like what that student actually needs. Like, man, that was it,
yeah.
you know, or even when it's good, like I had a student, like just anytime he played something good, it would just go to his head, you know. So I wasn't telling him he was so good all the time because he would just get, you know, not practice.
Kind of complacent.
Yep,
yeah. You know, so it was like a balance of that. You know, you don't want to be like, oh, that's terrible. But at the same time, it's like lifting them higher.
Yeah.
Always lifting higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ever better.
Yeah.
Well, the book is called Kids Boom. Aren't Lazy, Developing Motivation and Talent Through Music. And we've really appreciated the conversation this hour. And before we sort of wrap it up, Dr. Baines, you know, you're the expert in the room on on kids. I mean, anything we miss that we ought to take with us as we think about our kids and what's healthy and healthiest in terms of approaches with them?
I think at the end game, it's about developing a sense of self, right? And that what I want to see a kid come out of music is hearing them be able to say, I worked hard. I make things happen, right? Not necessarily that I made this particular thing happen, but I am capable of doing.
Well, Herb, some final thoughts from you as we think about, you know, the approach with our kids, especially when it comes to music.
Well, one of the things in her book that she talked about was she gave a little bit of a tip of the hat to the University of Rochester and used the word meliora, which means ever better. And I really like that because it's always about better. It's about getting to the next level, about raising up, about lifting up and not putting down. So, yeah, ever better.
Well, the Neely Author Series has brought Lauren Haley, and that event tonight, 6 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library on the University of Rochester's campus there, and you can park right in the lot there. There should be parking. It's free and open to the public, and a lot more on that. So whether you're Miriam thinking about your husband's still resenting the adults in his life going back to childhood, we all have those stories, but we all want to make sure that we're thinking about kids in the healthiest possible way here. And I love the title, Kids Aren't Lazy. But there's a lot of things that can capture their attention and pull them away from the focus of music. So some final thoughts from you as we wrap the
up. Yeah. I'd just like parents to know that as a parent, your superpower is having the highest level of faith in your child's potential. You are the most important teacher they will ever have. No Beethoven, Einstein, or Picasso could teach them more than you can. So, you know, be brave and show up to the lessons and be ready, you know, to take the good with the difficult, because no matter what, we're going to get a lot out of this journey together.
I like that distinction, the good and not the bad, the good and the difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren Haley. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it. The book's called Kids Aren't Lazy. It's out now. Thanks for being back in Rochester and talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Herb Smith, trumpeter with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. Always great to have you.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Dr. Kathleen Baines, who's a child psychiatrist, director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
The whole crew today, David Griffin volunteering. Thank you, David. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. When we say member-supported public radio, we don't do this often, but it's weeks like this that we need your support because we need the whole community coming together. We hope that you call 454-6300 and become a member or jump on WXXINews.org. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.